Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Brown, Associate Professor at City University of New York, and perhaps more importantly for our purposes, author of a book that I guess is just about to come out. I'm sure we'll talk about this, when it actually drops or if it's already dropped. It's called Homeschooling the Right, How Conservative Education Activism Erodes the State. So welcome, Heath, to Mindshift Podcast.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure. I'm a fan of the podcast, fan of what you're doing, and it's such a pleasure to have the chance to talk about these ideas and my little contribution and see how they fit into all the other things that you think about. So thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. We've been chatting on Twitter. That's how we met. And you've sent me a few articles, and I'm actually very interested to read your book because, of course, it dovetails with a lot of the stuff that Dr. Milton Gaither and I discussed a few months ago. Obviously, he's coming at it from, I suppose, more of an evangelical perspective, but the history of homeschooling, broader than just Christian homeschooling, of course, it's more than just a Christian movement, isn't it? When you go back to, I suppose, the 70s and 80s, when it really took off in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. And is there any book as important as Professor Gaither's book? That he wrote very much a historical treatment of homeschooling, sort of the capital H homeschooling, of the homeschooling that we sort of recognize now, but his central argument that the lowercase homeschooling that has stretched back centuries is very important to also consider. His work, his scholarship, his public engagement on scholarship more generally is remarkable. Was a huge aid to the work that I did and just has to be recognized for that, because he really does make this argument that there are a lot of things going on. This is not simple, that it is, though there are parts of homeschooling that appear confusing and hidden, that there is a full history to be told that is incorporated into the larger story about education in the United States, education globally. And it really does set the stage for all sorts of things. But like many important social phenomena, it is deeply political, conflicted at many points, and caught up in the terminology that often misrepresents different parts of a movement as singular and consensus-based, which is really not the case. And so as scholars, we try to approach these nuances and generalize when we can, point to detail when it's important. And that's really what I tried to do in the book, and owe a lot to Milton Gaither's work.
I certainly learned a lot from that episode. He's an absolute fount of knowledge on homeschooling in general, as you say, the historical aspects. He corrected a lot of, I guess, common misconceptions and fallacies. A lot of people think that Christian homeschooling is kind of the only movement, but that's not true. As we know, we had guys like John Holt and Raymond Moore and some of the other early pioneers, along with R.J. Rushdoony. That's how I got into the topic myself. I was researching Rushdoony and Christian Reconstructionism and Dominion Theology. That inevitably led me into his work as a homeschool legal advocate, all the work that he did going back to the 70s and 80s. And so that's where I came across Milton Gaither. He's the expert. You got to talk to him. So in that vein, you're not doing obviously the same thing that Milton Gaither is doing. What makes your book different in that sense?
Yeah, and I think that Rushdoony is a very good example. A prominent theologian, prominent in the sense that he's prominent in scholarly circles. His name is not commonplace outside of the somewhat small but influential religious circles that he ran in. But he's also a political figure. So like many others during the 1970s and 1980s, who wore multiple hats, he was developing and interpreting a set of religious interpretations, but was also applying them to the world that around him. And he did so within the courts and was a prominent activist defending the rights of homeschoolers, not just on religious grounds, but religion certainly played an important part. But he's also a national figure participating in federal level politics, federal policymaking, was active in national political groups like the Council for National Policy, mm-hmm. which was one of the, they refer to as the most powerful organization that you've never heard of. Now, I think maybe it's become a little bit more heard of, better heard of now, but it still remains a pretty secretive organization. Yet it has, since the early 1980s, represented some of the most influential conservative figures, including officials in the Trump White House. And so Rashtuni's position in multiple societal realms makes him influential. And he's influential around the ideas behind homeschooling, a certain type of homeschooling. But he's also very influential in making sure that the courts interpret things in that way and agree with his central premise that this is something that should be a right. It should be a protected right. And families should not be prosecuted for opting to homeschool, even when the laws or rules, which they were at the point at which he was active in the late 1970s and early 1980s, were ambiguous and unclear and did not necessarily send clear messages to educational officials. And he advocated for a pretty clear stance that that ambiguity should always be interpreted in favor of the family choosing to homeschool, and that they should be permitted, if not encouraged, to act on their wishes to educate their family, their children in the home. He had specific reasons for believing that, but he pursued them both in kind of the secular courts, as well as in the arguments within church groups. And so he is incredibly mm-hmm. important, but he's very important as a political figure, not just as a figure within the practice of homeschooling or the interpretation of Christianity.
What struck me when I read the articles that you sent me about your book and your work that you've been doing, you've been researching this a long time, I think, I immediately went to Rashtuni, because to me, what you're describing when you're talking about the Christian right using, let's say, Christian homeschool groups and groups of homeschool kids for political rallies and campaigns and to help the Republican Party and whatever their agenda is, I immediately thought, well, that's dominion theology essentially in action. That's the vision that Rashtuni had, which was a generational thing. He said it may take hundreds of years, but we've got to educate these kids in the home, ideally, or at least in a Christian school. That's kind of the second best thing. And then eventually there'll be enough of us, if we have big families, quiverful kind of theology, we will take over. We will run this place. And you know, it's an inevitable wave eventually. And that's what I thought when I read your book, read your article. I thought, wow, this is a Rushdunian sort of dominion theology reconstructionist vision coming to pass.
Yeah, what's so interesting, when I read Rashtuni, not being a religion scholar, what I immediately thought is that is policy feedback. Mm. Political scientists have this theory that just as politics creates policy, in the kind of way that we would all learn, you know, in secondary school. But once policy happens, once the law is passed, it then shapes politics. And it does so in a couple of ways. And one of the main ways is for those that interact with the policy, whether it's a healthcare policy or it's an education policy, we are shaped by that interaction. Sometimes those interactions are quite negative. Anyone who's gone to get a driver's license is often frustrated by the experience. Mm-hmm. Interactions with the local bureaucracy, trying to make a simple change in your home, will result in months of protracted battles.
Mm-hmm. Lots of fees.
local bureaucrats simply doing their job.
Sure.
But in doing their job, they're resulting in enormous frustration. And this theoretical idea of policy feedback says that's going to shape our views towards government. And negative interactions with government, the result of policies that say you can't simply add a floor to your home, you've got to get local zoning permission, results in changed views. So sometimes policy has that effect of changing our attitudes. sometimes it has the effect of changing the amount of money in our pocket. And in doing so, changes our political capacity. We have more free time because public policy means we don't have to work two jobs, or we get free healthcare. So that means that we don't have to work 80 hours a week to simply pay for the basic healthcare. That's going to mean that we have more free time to engage in politics. And mm-hmm. so the idea is that there are these knock-on effects of policy. And when I saw what Rushduni was describing, I said, that's policy feedback. What he is interested in doing is having this policy option for families, interested both in the immediate education of these children. And I think that he genuinely thought that kids would be educated better. I think he was deeply concerned about secular education. I think he was deeply concerned mm-hmm. about public schooling in the United States. But that he also saw this mid to long-term outcome, which is when children return to the home and when parents took over the education of their children and they were able to strip out the parts that they found offensive and incorporate elements of the Bible into instruction, which at that point was largely prohibited in public schools. What it could do is to transform families and children. And that's not just to transform them into being better at arithmetic. It was also to give them a vision for their life that's highly connected to his social vision, which was for a reintroduction of a certain vision for Christianity into the public square, into the way in which society worked, something that he saw as a fault of modernity, that the move from the 1960s into 1970s, he saw as the move of Christianity and the church out of the public square. And he was interested in many ways in pushing it back in. And homeschooling mm-hmm. was one of those ways that you could reintroduce this as a way, because you couldn't do it through the public schools because prayer in school had been outlawed by the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Religious instruction was not taking place in public schools. And so this was a way to accomplish a quite far-reaching vision for society. And it need not be that every homeschool family agreed with this or adopted it. You simply mm-hmm. need a sufficient number to agree with this and to pursue this kind of vision. And so one of the reactions to the book from people that I know, friends, families, I'm sure people that you know, would say, but we participated in homeschooling. What you're describing sounds nothing like mm-hmm. what we did in the home. I don't know who you're talking about. Who is this Rushduni character?
Exactly.
Who are these organizations?
Never heard of him.
We didn't do anything like that. All we did is we set up a school in our backyard, in our basement, and we got textbooks, and we worked really hard to make sure our kids learned just as much as they would have learned in the school. And then we decided it because we live in a rural community and it was too far to take the kids to school, or, you know, we didn't like what the school was offering in terms of chemistry or French or whatever. And they said that we have nothing to do with this political movement you're describing. And what I say to those people is, you're absolutely right that a movement doesn't take, a policy doesn't take every person who participates to also participate in the political movement. All you need is a sufficiently large number that some of the other politics happens. And I think that's much of what we observe in the United States. It's not a mm-hmm. universal, the case is not universally that every family that homeschools is either Republican, registered, conservative, Christian, or any of that. But a sufficiently large number has been to make this a potent political force. And so that's some of the argument that I try to build in the book, is not for a universal movement, but for a movement that's very effective in taking a certain perspective on politics and providing, as Rushduni and Gary North and others would say, and George Bush would even say, the foot soldiers of the conservative movement, that absent a way to provide this kind of education might not be so possible.
And we know, okay, so Rushduni's work, his activism, the idea of homeschooling just in general, because as you say, I think you mentioned, it wasn't legal when they first really were trying to get it off the ground back in the late 60s, early 70s. You couldn't homeschool. They had to change the laws. They had to change the policies. So he went state to state arguing in courts and trying to get these laws changed or overturned or repealed or added to the books. And that led to, I think, two things, didn't it? One is this homeschooling sort of legal defense arm, groups like the HSLDA. And then it's essentially the other end is it's become a sort of a political lobbying organization. I'm reading your article on the Columbia University Press blog, and you talk about a certain legislator in Michigan told ProPublica, quote, "I've never seen a lobby," referring to the Christian homeschooling lobby, "more powerful and scary." And then you've got a really good quote here from Clay and Sally Clarkson in their 1999 book, Practical Homeschooling. This is really interesting. They say, quote, "Support the cause. Get involved in protecting your homeschool heritage by becoming politically active. Write and visit your state and federal legislators to educate them on Christian home education. Put a Christian face on what for them might be an anonymous public policy issue. Get their aides, get to know their aides and office staff," end quote. I mean, that says it all right there, doesn't it? They did get politically active, and they are politically active even now today, especially with the coronavirus. We've got more people homeschooling their kids because they have no choice. Their schools are closed.
Yeah, one of the great myths or misunderstandings of homeschooling has been that it has led to social isolation, mm-hmm. and that it has been a form of dropout. And so for those uninformed, one of the great myths of homeschooling is that these are families and children who have simply dropped out. They become socially isolated, disconnected. They don't leave their home. The reality for most families is really very, very different than that. Rather than saying we are going to leave the public school system and everything else, many families have actually doubled down on their political involvement. And rather than saying we've left the public school system and we're not going to go out and vote, and we're not going to participate in elections, they've said, in order to protect this right, we're going to do twice as much as a typical family might do because we believe in this so much. And so that article, that recommendation in Practical Homeschooling Magazine said families that subscribe to this very widely read magazine, if you want to continue to homeschool, if you want this right protected, you can't assume that legislators are going to understand who you are. And mm-hmm. they're going to believe things about you that may be untrue. So go to the Capitol, write letters, volunteer on campaigns, make sure that the vision for this that you believe in, which is that you should have the right, nearly unprotected, to educate your kids at home, with little of the oversight that exists in other education sectors, including private schools, you've got to go out there. You've got to make yourself heard. And the organizations, both at the local, state, and national level, help support this. And so there are prominent national and state organizations that whenever there is a bill introduced that even sticks a toe into the world of homeschooling, has an active and readily mobilizable group of parents and children who have been prepared to go and talk to legislators, mm-hmm. to make phone calls, to write letters. And that has been a part of the strategy, is to say, in order to defend our rights, you have to be ready to get up and do it. Mm-hmm. And homeschooling can't mean for you not participating. And so that's a surprising to many people, because most people would say, no, it's too small. There are not enough of them to be a political force. How could they be scary? Part of the reason that they're scary is they have been so effectively energized, informed, and mobilized, not by just one or two organizations, but by a vast, effective, well-supported network of organizations that work together in common cause. This is not the absence of civil society. This is the flourishing of civil society. It mm-hmm. just so happens that it's done parallel to the civil society that most people have come to understand. This is not the PTA that most people know. This is a set of organizations that is running really parallel to the PTA. Mm-hmm. For that reason, it's often not observed. But if you're a legislator, you know who these organizations are, because if you even whisper about introducing a bill that might impact those families who homeschool, you'll hear from them again and again and again and again. Next time you think about trying to do that again, you say, maybe this isn't right for me. Maybe I should just allow them to do their thing. And so there are countless examples of even the most innocuous, apparently innocuous, rule changes that might only peripherally impact families who homeschool, even those barely incidental policy changes are met with enormous resistance, often at the state level and the federal level as well.
That's it. I know you talk about that in your article. I'm sure you must pick this up in your book, that you struggled on some levels just to talk to people that are representing homeschooling groups and homeschooling families. You say in your article that they don't want to be studied, but they do want to be heard. They seek privacy from the state at all costs, but they remain hyper-visible and active in politics, and especially in presidential campaigns. So you've got this sort of paradox going on where they want privacy, they don't want to be studied, they don't want to be investigated, but yet, man, if you talk about the most, like you say, the most obscure, seemingly innocuous change, they will flood your office with phone calls, emails, faxes, whatever way they can get a hold of you. We'll come back in just a minute and finish up the second half of my conversation with Heath Brown, talking about his book, Homeschooling the Right. I'm curious to find out in the next half of this conversation, I want to bring up an issue with Heath, and that is an issue that I've uncovered in my study of Christian homeschooling. Because this community is so insular and so closed off and doesn't want to be studied, even though they have a growing political influence, the very fact that they are such a closed off and insular community, that in turn has given rise to some pretty shocking abuses because they are not being observed by states and by local law enforcement. Some homeschooling parents can get away with a lot, and there's been some pretty shocking abuses that have been uncovered. So we're going to get into that in the next half of the conversation. But before we do, I'd like to give a shout out to Joe Scyther. Thank you, Joe, for being the latest Patreon supporter of Mindshift Podcast. This was off the back of the episode that I just did with Frank Schaefer. If you haven't heard that, you need to go back and listen to that, because some of what Frank and I talked about does dovetail with what Heath and I are talking about now. And that is this vision that R.J. Rush Dooney had of establishing not just Christian schools, but specifically Christian homeschools. And that was all part and parcel of his Reconstructionist sort of theonomist vision. And we're seeing that even with the appointment of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court and her sort of worldview, that's in a sense kind of the Reconstructionist project decades later that has come to fruition. And part of that is this issue of homeschooling places like Patrick Henry College, founded by Michael Ferris of the HSLDA. He was now the leader of the ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom, and there's some connections there with Amy Coney Barrett. So there's a lot of overlap when we talk about this stuff. And what we're describing is this vision that he and his father, Francis Schaefer, had decades ago, along with other key evangelical and fundamentalist religious right leaders back in the 1970s and the 1980s. It's all starting to come full circle now. We're seeing the establishment of a theocracy. And so this Christian homeschooling plays into that vision as well. So this is why I'm getting the word out. And in fact, the next episode that's coming up here on Mindshift Podcast features an interview with Dr. John Fia, who has done a tremendous amount of work writing and research on the origins of the Christian right and what's going on in Trump world right now. And then I've also got a chat scheduled with Andrew Jasko. He's been on the podcast a couple times a few years ago. We're going to be talking about a project that he's working on around this area of spirituality and recovering from religious trauma syndrome. And that's a very important thing to discuss in terms of rebuilding your identity, rebuilding your life. If you've come out of religion, whatever it is, could be fundamentalist Christianity, could be a cult, whatever you came out of, you might have religious trauma syndrome. So that's an important one coming out soon with Andrew Jasko. I'm also really excited because we've got some fantastic Mindshift Zoom calls coming up in the months of October and November, and hopefully in December as well. We have got Paul Kivel on the 25th of October dropping in, talking about his work on Christian hegemony. Then in November, we have two Zoom calls. We've got Peter Montgomery of the Right Wing Watch. We're going to be talking with him. And then on the 22nd of November, we've got Sam Perry and Andrew Whitehead stopping by to talk about their book, Taking America Back for God. And I'm also in talks with Frank Schaefer. I'm hoping to book him in early December to be our guest for that. And these calls are available only to the closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group members, the members who support the show on Patreon. So if you want to be a part of those calls, support the show on Patreon, and that will give you access to these fantastic Zoom calls. All right, let's get on back into the conversation with Heath Brown as we look at this issue of abuses in homeschooling contexts and how specifically the Christian right is using these homeschool kids to further their political agenda. But of course, there's a downside to it too, because what I've studied is that this extreme privacy has also resulted in a lot of abuses being covered up or not known, because the state will not go into these homeschooling households. And that gives them, certain parents, in a sense, like a license to abuse kids, and no one will ever know about it. So that's got to be one of the downsides. You must have uncovered some of that in your research.
Yeah, there are some terrible, terrible examples of child abuse. Mm-hmm. But we don't know across the board what the levels or rates of this actually are. Mm. So we don't know the magnitude of this. We don't know if this is a major problem or a minor problem. But that's in part because we don't know, because the data collection is very limited. And we can speculate, but the effectiveness of the political advocacy around homeschooling has been to make it very difficult in some states to even know how many students are homeschooled. Mm-hmm. So in a state like Michigan, you would be hard pressed to figure out exactly how many students are homeschooled. You'd be hard-pressed to know something like how many homeschool teachers have teacher certification mm-hmm. or a college degree. It would be very hard to know those very things that we know in excruciating detail about the public school system and even the private school system. We simply don't know in the case of homeschooling.
It's like a black hole.
Yeah, and so and when you believe in liberty, when you believe that this is a right, I think many organizations would say that's okay. That there is nothing, the ways the rules have been written means that they are not required to abide by all of the rules of public schools. And that's okay. That's debatable. It's hotly debated.
Absolutely.
What I can say is that despite this, I had the good fortune to interview dozens of leaders of homeschool organizations who were willing to give me a lot of time to talk about their work, to talk about their motivations, to talk about the way in which they advocated for a cause that they believed in deeply. And despite what one might think, which is the great difficulty of getting anyone to talk, I actually had a great deal of luck. Now, that's different than saying you can field a national survey and have large response rates, because I think there are great skepticism on the part of many homeschool families about being studied. But to write the book, I had the pleasure of having very interesting and thoughtful conversations with the leaders of homeschool organizations. The book that I wrote is not about the families who homeschool. There have been great books written about that.
Mm-hmm.
About exactly the pedagogy used and the various reasons why one approach to homeschooling might be better than another. That is not the research that I did. What I did very much is look at those that advocate for those families, how they do it, why they do it, the effectiveness of the way they did it. And they are pretty remarkable. If you go into many a community across rural United States, you will find many examples of historic important institutions like libraries and post offices and even hospitals shuttered at the same time in many of those very same communities, 1, 2, 3, 4 different homeschool organizations. So that if you opt to homeschool, you have an organization that can help you figure out which textbooks to choose and another organization that is coordinating extracurricular activities. And if you so choose, another organization that is connected with the religious beliefs, often Christian in the community, but there may be another one that is secular. And mm-hmm. so what we have then is this network, webs across some of the parts of the country that we assume the exact opposite of when it comes to homeschooling. there isn't a void of civil society. In fact, civil society is quite active and effective. And that's a paradox that I think made me so interested in this educational movement and this political movement, because it turns on its head many of the things that people think about rural and suburban communities in the United States, which have become devoid of social capital. When it comes to homeschooling, there is extensive social capital, and that social capital has been turned into political capital, which is why homeschooling laws never revert back to what they used to be. They are in a direct frontward march in the direction of more exemptions and more freedom rather than less. And that's not the case in other education reforms like charter schooling, which tends to go forward and back, and there are changes, and that's not what we have seen in homeschooling.
What do you find, or what I should say, what have you found in terms of your research in this area of the Christian right using these homeschool kids? Because in my research, I've come across things like Generation Joshua, or the Joshua Generation, which I think was founded by Michael Ferris, who also founded the HSLDA and Patrick Henry College. Now, this is a pipeline for homeschool kids to get involved in politics, typically conservative Republican politics. And of course, Patrick Henry College is a conduit for 75 to 80% homeschool kids who go on into higher education. And they then, a lot of them get placed as interns all the way back to the Bush administration in 2000, all the way to today, the Trump administration, Republican senators, congressmen and women, Supreme Court justices, and that's their way into the corridors of power, in a sense, with this dominionist sort of ideology or worldview. Is that kind of what you uncovered when you started talking to these homeschool families?
Yes. As I said before, it doesn't take every homeschool family to volunteer on a political campaign or for a movement to be influential. And the organizations that you just described, including the Joshua Generation Group, which is basically a volunteer organization which encourages homeschool high school students and provides for them a way to volunteer on campaigns, typically Republican campaigns. They have taken credit for turning out lots and lots of volunteers, so much so that in some cases, this has become a part of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. When you educate at home, you've got a lot of control over what you teach. And there are examples going back to 2000. The first of which was Homeschoolers for Bush. Mm-hmm. And there was a push to get homeschool families to rally around the campaign of George W. Bush, to use the flexibility in their curriculum, to use the fall of 2000, as a curricular activity where they designed a point-based system that said, if you registered to vote, you get this number of points. If you give out voter registration cards, you get this amount of points. If you volunteer on a Republican campaign, you get this amount of points. If you volunteer a lot on that campaign, you get even more points.
What do you win with all these points?
you
gold stars?
You do really well in the class.
Right.
But it was something that started kind of as an idea and then became a bigger idea and then became a real thing. So much so that when George W. Bush won his election in 2000, he sent letters around to all these organizations thanking them and saying, you were some of the foot soldiers of my successful campaign. You went out there and you knocked on doors. You volunteered. You did the things necessary for me to win. And Republican candidates ever since have often courted homeschool families and homeschool organizations, knowing that they are dependable and effective canvassers. So Governor Mike Huckabee in 2008, when he ran for the presidency and ran in the Iowa caucuses, credits homeschool volunteers for his successful win in Iowa. Now, he didn't go on to win the nomination, but he felt like these were the people that made the difference. He gave them direct credit, so much so that in subsequent elections, Michelle Bachmann, Ted Cruz courted homeschool organizations, thinking that this could be a part of an electoral strategy, not electoral in the voting sense. You could never win an election based on the 3% of families who homeschool across the country, but as a campaign strategy, as the very people who would be effective in going to the homes of sympathetic, I mean, how do you turn down a high school student knocking on your door saying, mm-hmm. you know, I support this candidate and I think you should too. And I share your pavement. Values. I go to your church. We mm-hmm. believe the same things. I'm even doing this as a class project. That's how much I care about this. And so a series of candidates have turned to these organizations, said, we want your volunteers. We want you to come out. And that's been a form of political capital. And so it's been something that has elevated these families. And so there are stories that have been told by others about students who go to Patrick Henry College, going on to get White House internships, going on to work on Capitol Hill. They've been very effective in placing people into these offices. And again, you don't have to have millions and millions of voters if you have people effective at politics. And that's been really one of the cases here, which, you know, made the election in 2016 such a curious one, because Ted Cruz was really courting these families, and they had been successful in the past. One of the most prominent national leaders, Michael Farris, who had been central to the success of the homeschooling movement at the national level, in many ways was the face of the movement at the national level since the early 1980s. 2016, he had left the prominent homeschool organization, but only for a related conservative organization. Mm-hmm. But he wrote the Washington Post that he could not support Donald Trump, that the politics that he supported didn't put character to the side. And he said that the movement, the conservative movement that he had been a part of since the 1980s was not consistent with the campaign of Donald Trump. And even though some of his very closest friends were endorsing Donald Trump, in the Washington Post, Michael Farris said, not me, I can't do this. That was a really very interesting moment. It did not cost the homeschooling movement. Michael Farris's decision not to endorse Donald Trump did not prevent them from ultimately, from Donald Trump winning the election, obviously, but more important than that, from not having an incredibly sympathetic Secretary of Education chosen, who is as sympathetic and interested in homeschooling and the adjacent homeschooling issues like school vouchers and Christian private education as Betsy DeVos. No Secretary of Education, Republican or Democrat, has been as conversant in what matters to homeschooling and those that have advocated for related issues of religious liberty and parental freedom as Betsy DeVos. And so even though many in the homeschooling movement didn't back Donald Trump with the enthusiasm that they backed George Bush in 2000, the movement still got a champion at the Department of Education. And there have been policies proposed and adopted that have been very consistent with what as many in the homeschooling movement have been interested in, including during the pandemic with overtures to provide financial support for the costs associated with homeschooling, which has never been a part of what homeschooling has been all about. They have been steadfast, national and state leaders have been steadfast in saying no to government support, always out of the fear that a little bit of government support will result in more government regulation. That's always been the stance. Yeah. The last 4 years has seen a shift in that and a much greater willingness to accept policy proposals that could provide tax credits, indirect benefits to underwrite the cost of homeschooling. And that's in part because there is a Secretary of Education who is deeply, deeply sympathetic with the cause.
All right, so this is my last question. I'm curious now that there's been this change, as you say, okay, maybe a lot of them didn't support Trump back in 2015, 16. Do you think that, given your research, have you seen that they have now come around, most of the Christian homeschooling families? I don't want to generalize, but are they pro-Trump 2020? Do you think they're working hard to get him reelected here in this election coming up?
You know, I haven't seen homeschoolers for Trump in a way that we saw homeschoolers for Cruz or homeschoolers for Bachman or homeschoolers for Huckabee or homeschoolers for Bush. So I haven't observed that. Surely there are many supporters of Donald Trump, but it is not the case that 90%+ of homeschool families are Republicans. It's not the case that 90%+ 80% of homeschool families voted for Donald Trump in 2016. We have a little bit of information that suggests a majority of homeschool families supported Donald Trump, but not a vast majority, not three quarters. And so I suspect that some of the ambivalence that we saw articulated by Michael Farris is shared more widely across the homeschooling community. And what's happened between 1980 and 2020 is that homeschooling has increased remarkably, nearing 2 million families this year. Now, who knows how many families homeschool now? We really have no way to count during the pandemic. But last year at this time, the number was approaching 2 million. As it has crept up, it's become a more diverse, socioeconomically diverse, racially diverse, I would guess ideologically diverse as well. And so unlike, let's say, 15 to 20 years ago, when the conservative and Christian thread through the homeschooling movement was prominent, I think we've seen a good deal more diversity recently, which interestingly harkens back to the 1970s and 1980s, when homeschooling saw progressives and libertarians and conservatives come together around this shared goal of making homeschooling legal and acceptable. But at that time period, these were progressives, hippies, and Christian conservatives all coming together. And in a funny kind of way, I think we may be approaching a period where this homeschooling movement is much more diverse in its belief systems and its underlying values and goals. And while there still may be many prominent conservative and religiously conservative homeschoolers, there may be more progressives and liberals homeschooling today than, let's say, 20 years ago.
So your book is called Homeschooling the Right: How Conservative Education Activism Erodes the State. And I'm reading this review of your book on that Columbia University Press website. And I think Kristen Goss, she says it well, that the helpful thing about your book is that it helps situate the homeschooling movement within the larger new right or Christian right enterprise. So thank you for your research. This has been a really interesting conversation. I think if people are interested and want to learn more about what's going on in the Christian right, Christian nationalism, Christian homeschooling, definitely your book sounds like a fantastic resource.
I'd love for everybody to read the book. If they don't, there's lots more on the subject matter. I always endorse the stuff that I write, but the book is out in January. Until then, go and buy Milton Gaither's book. And when you're done with his book, then go buy my book.
By that time, it'll be out. So yeah, it's quite a thick book, Milton Gaither's book. So it won't be quite as thick. How can people get a hold of you in terms of social media? Where can they find you?
On Twitter, at Heath Brown, be the best way to follow me. And I share the other things that I write about the subject that are not bound up in book form, and willingly share them with the world. So I'm very excited for people to read the book. I understand that this is a controversial subject for a lot of people. There has been a lot of written about the subject matter that is unsympathetic to families who homeschool, and I try to bring to the work the sympathy of somebody who has had many excellent students in my college career educated in homeschools, and in a sort of a sympathy for them and what they have gone through as a way to make sense of this as a political and historical phenomenon. And that's what I tried to bring to the book.
Sounds like an excellent resource. Well, thank you, Heath Brown, for talking to me. I've enjoyed this conversation. I look forward to when your book finally comes out.
Thank you.